You prepared. You knew the material. The meeting started, and the moment you opened your mouth, you heard yourself. And something changed, not in the room, but in you. You started speaking faster. You rushed to finish before someone interrupted. And by the end, you weren't sure if they understood you or if they even tried. That feeling has a name. And today, we're going to deal with it. Welcome back to The Fluent Edge, the podcast for professionals around the world who want to speak English with more confidence and clarity. I'm Sean Watson, your English communication coach.
And I am Dr. Howie Jacobson, author, leadership coach, and mindset strategist.
Today, we're getting into one of the most requested topics we've ever had, accent anxiety and executive presence. Specifically, why your accent is almost certainly not what's holding you back, and what actually is, and what you can do about it before your next English conversation. And for anyone who's ever been told to work on your accent, stay with us because there's an important distinction coming that's going to reframe this for you.
This is your work. You coach executives, senior professionals every week. Why is this one of the most requested topics we've gotten for this podcast? What does accent anxiety look like?
I've got a client right now. Let's call him Peter. He's a senior engineer at a tech company. And he tells me, Sean, I know what I want to say. The ideas are clear. But the moment I speak in English with native English speakers in a meeting, I feel like I'm losing credibility. And here's what's interesting. His English is excellent. His vocabulary is sophisticated. His accent is German. And his instinct, his genuine belief, is that it's the accent causing the problem, that if he sounded more native, he'd be taken more seriously. But when I actually listen to him speak, the accent isn't the issue. What I'm hearing is he rushes, he drops the ends of his sentences, and he qualifies everything. He'll say something like, I think maybe we could possibly consider, you know what I mean by that, right? And by the time he gets to the idea, he's already lost people in the room. So it's not really an accent problem. It's more of a delivery problem. And those are very different things.
But it sounds like the accent anxiety actually contributes to the delivery problem by creating anxiety.
Yeah, accent bias is also a real phenomenon, for sure. And there have been studies that say that identical content is rated as less credible when delivered with a non-native accent. But how do leaders develop the psychological resilience, in your opinion, Howie, to operate confidently in that environment anyway?
I would say, first of all, you want to make sure that you are being understood. Like, for example, for me, anyone who with an accent who speaks in a sophisticated manner in English, I just assume they're smarter than me because they know my language and I don't know theirs. So I'm sure there are people for whom accent anxiety is appropriate, right? That their accent is so thick that it's actually difficult for native speakers to follow them. It might be rare, but I would want to know that's not the case. So begin by having one-on-one conversations and get honest feedback, which tells you where you stand. So you're oriented to reality. So once you have external evidence that the accent isn't the problem, then we can begin to explore why having accent anxiety arises anyway, because it still will. Because if Peter knows that people understand him, that immediately is not going to solve his problem. He's probably not going to instantly become comfortable and fluid in his presentations. There's still that fear. So then it's a matter of identifying what the fear is, how it plays out in the body, and what our bodies default to do in cases of fear. And every one of us has a signature of how we will express a threat response in our bodies, and it'll differ. For me, I might talk much faster and become more animated and really try to get, and I really want you to nod along with me because I feel safer if we're on the same page. For someone else, it might be to get real quiet and ask, is this okay? Are you sure? I'm going to qualify this 12 ways so I don't get attacked. There's all sorts of different physiologies that underlie our behavior, including our speech patterns. So that's where I would look if I were trying to help someone overcome this.
And from the language side, the distinction I always come back to is intelligibility versus accent. So intelligibility means people can understand you clearly. Accent, in many ways, is just the musical pattern of your speech, where you're from, how your consonants and vowels were shaped growing up or when you were learning English or another language. And those are not the same thing. You can have a strong accent and be completely intelligible. So the work isn't to sound like a native speaker. The work is to speak clearly enough that your ideas land.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I don't know if this is backed up by research, but I find that North American English speakers tend to like accents. And I've heard from Americans who've moved to Italy and can speak Italian well, but not with an Italian accent, that they often feel like people are responding like fingers on the chalkboard. Like, it hurts me to hear you use my language this way. I don't think that's the case for people who are working in a North American environment. I can't speak to Britain, Australia, New Zealand, but I think people have a lot more freedom to sound like themselves and not mask their origins.
If we take a city like Toronto, my hometown, 50% of the people you pass by in the street in Toronto were born in another country. Huh. So you have a wide variety, a wide spectrum of different kinds of English. For example, I'm working with somebody from Ghana who grew up learning British English, and now he's living in Canada. And we're working on adjusting his letter R's, for example. He'll say future, right? Which is fine in certain British accents. But in his current profession, he spends a lot of time doing public speaking, and people sometimes can't understand what future is. So now we're working on bringing that R more forward, that harder North American R, future, like that. And again, it's not a judgment call on how he speaks or anything. When I work with people from India, many of them have studied English from the beginning of their education. And in some ways, Indian English can be quite different from American or Canadian English.
All right, so let's get concrete. If we want to help people with their delivery, what is the specific delivery and language signals that create this executive presence, which is a feeling that the person who's speaking is knowledgeable, trustworthy, and has authority?
Yeah, three things in particular come to mind, and none of them are about accent. The first is pace. When someone slows down slightly, not unnaturally, just thoughtfully, listeners register it as confidence. They see it or they hear it as more confidence. And as you pointed out earlier, speed often reads as anxiety or sales pressure. Somebody's trying to sell me something. So slowing down reads as gravitas. And that's the word, gravitas. And this could be a new word for people who don't have the Latin or the cognate connection. Gravitas comes from Latin. The word is gravis, which means heavy or weighty or serious. It describes a kind of authority that commands respect without demanding it. And pace is the fastest way to signal it. So if you're nervous, slow down by 20%, not 50, just 20. And the second point is signal. Signal is structure. So leading with your point before your explanation, coming up with the bottom line up front, and don't make your listener work to find your conclusion, right? Give them the headline first and then the reasoning. So you could say something like, I recommend we delay the launch, instead of saying, there are several factors to consider. And if we look at Q3, blah, 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 blah. So by the time you get there, you've lost people. And finally, for number three, is really what I would call the ownership of silence. I like silence when I'm on my own or with my wife, where we can be silent together for a long time. But I find when I'm in a meeting, that pause makes me feel like I have to fill it. For non-native speakers, that's even more so. It creates anticipation if you pause a little bit, and it makes the next thing you say have more impact.
Yeah, one thing that comes to me is when we talk about pace is that speaking is a form of breathing, right? And you as an opera singer, I remember when I was doing opera, all the breathing exercises I had to do or the sound exercises that were really focused on where am I breathing? What's relaxing? What's tensing? And so if you are speaking quickly, you're also breathing very quickly. And to the animal brain, there's a part of our nervous system that doesn't understand words, but it understands energy and signals the same way that if we were, you know, a gazelle in a herd somewhere. And then when you see someone, your nervous system attunes and you prick up your ears to there must be a threat somewhere. I want to come back to the third one, though. So it's easy to say we want to have deliberate silences rather than awkward silences. A lot of people wouldn't know how to tell the difference. So what does deliberate silence look like in a professional conversation?
The difference is in the intention behind it. Awkward silence is reactive. It happens when you've lost your train of thought or you've lost your thread and you're searching for a word and the gap opens up uninvited in a way. But deliberate, intentional silence is a choice. So you pause before answering a difficult question. You pause after making a key point to let it, as we say in English, sink in. I work with a client at the moment who's a diplomat. She does a lot of negotiations in English, and her biggest breakthrough wasn't vocabulary. It wasn't grammar. It was learning to pause for 2 full seconds before responding to a challenging question. So just 2 seconds. And she told me, Sean, it feels like an eternity. And I said, to you, it does. But to the room, it sounds more like wisdom, right? So the person who fills every gap sounds uncertain. And the person who owns an intentional gap can sound more measured and more thoughtful.
I remember going to a book signing by a woman who had written books on sort of Buddhist meditation. And the thing that really struck me is that she was up on stage and then people would gather by the microphone in the aisle and ask questions. And for every question, she took at least 10, 15 seconds, sometimes 30 seconds after they asked to be in silence. And then she spoke clearly, kindly. And what I took away from that was she didn't know the answer. She knew yesterday's answer, but today's answer might be different. And so she was giving respect to the question. And if you're meeting people for the first time and you do that in a professional setting, it might come across as weird. Mm-hmm. If you set up and practice that on a regular basis, that Sean is a thoughtful guy. He takes his time before responding. And I might even encourage people who feel awkward about this to say, that's a great question. Do you mind if I take a few seconds to bring my thoughts together before I respond? I really want to take my time with this. Something came to mind, but I think there might be a little bit more. I'm a huge fan of narrating your inner dialogue in a way that makes you transparent. I was working with someone yesterday who wanted to have a hard conversation and didn't know how to begin. And what if you just said that to the person? I want to have this conversation with you, but I'm a little bit scared of having it. And I'm not sure how to begin. And immediately that produces empathy, vulnerability, understanding. So you don't have to be awkward about it and you don't have to become performative. You could say, I need a few seconds to think.
That's lovely. I'm working with another person who's preparing to go to an Ivy League university in the US. And so we're working on the interview process. And his difficulty is that he often pauses for too long without saying anything. He'll just pause. So we're really working on what we call bridge phrases. As I said, that's interesting. Or let me think about that for a moment. Or I haven't thought about that for a while. Or maybe my answer will be different today than it was yesterday. So I love that, Howie, especially for non-native English speakers at the beginning, when they're really practicing or trying to become more intentional with their silences. I think some sort of a bridge phrase like that, just to buy a little bit of time and to suggest that maybe a bit of silence would be helpful.
It's funny because we use the phrase non-native speakers of English, but everyone I work with is a non-native speaker of certain types of communication.
Absolutely.
Whether it's the language of coaching, if I'm used to just giving you advice or giving you feedback or telling you what to do, and now I'm going to coach you, it really is like learning another language. So all of us are non-native. There's always more to learn. There's always another level of communication excellence that we can that we can try to attain. And it is like learning another language. You're going to have to practice it. You're going to have to hear other people do it. You're going to have to receive it as comprehensible input. And you're going to slowly make it your own by making mistakes. And not to get too political, but I do like to get political every now and then. There's a language teacher that I follow who says the difference between a dialect and a language is an army and a navy. And that language, and especially accents, have always been a way to determine class. If you're Oxbridge in the UK, you're smart. If you're East End of London, Cockney, then you're presumed to be of a lower class.
Yes.
It was one of the nice things when I lived in London, because I did not have a British accent, I could not be pigeonholed. People didn't know whether I was smart or stupid. They had to get to know me to find out.
So Howie, why does slowing down and owning silence feel so threatening to people psychologically?
Because if you're under threat, the last thing you want to do is slow down. Right? If there's a saber-toothed tiger growling and stalking you, it's not natural to take a pause, to take a breath. Your body is preparing you. to get out of there, to flee, to make a quick decision, and to go to tunnel vision about the threat, right? So that's probably a good thing when it comes to a saber-toothed tiger. I don't want part of my brain to be thinking about that blackberry hedge or the cave woman that I want to court later. But when we're focused on threat in front of a group of people where there is no threat, and our physiology tells us that there is, it's just a classic mismatch situation. So we have to learn how to practice before the meeting, before the presentation, imagine yourself in that situation. Really feel their stares. Imagine their disapproval. Feel your body doing what it's going to do. And in that moment, practice slowing down. Practice saying your first sentence slowly and pausing afterwards, right? To do those reps before you need them.
Getting back to the leading with your point idea, from a leadership and executive presence perspective, why do even experienced leaders still bury the lead, Howie? And what's the psychological pull toward building the case before delivering the verdict?
I think it's because delivering the line is more risky because you're standing behind something. So again, there's a perceived threat of what if they think I'm wrong? What if they don't trust my reasoning? So I'm going to build up to it. It's a flight behavior. If we're, again, classifying it neurologically, avoidance is a form of flight. So the longer I talk around something without getting to the point that I'm worried people are going to judge me on, then the longer I can feel a little bit safe. Of course, it doesn't make you safe. It just reinforces any doubts people have. So by the time you do make your case, you've already undermined it with your own physiology.
I would say from a language point of view, the language fix is simple, even if the habit isn't. So flip the order. Make your point first, support after, especially if you're still feeling uncomfortable about speaking in a second language in a meeting.
Yeah, and there's ways to make the point and not soften it, but to anticipate objections, to say, I think that we should double our ad spend in this market for the third quarter. Now, I'm imagining that some of you have doubts about that, and I totally get it because it's taken me a while to come to this conclusion. I'm going to share my reasoning so that you can feel good. Here's what I think we should do, and I understand if you don't agree. So here, I'd like to share my reasoning, and we can look at it together. Because if I come in and I feel like my identity is tied up in doubling ad spend on social media in the third quarter, and you don't like it, then you've attacked me. If I come in and say, here's my best thinking, I'm presenting it to you to hear what you think. Can we improve this together? Then I don't own it. If you then say, I think we could do that, but I also think we should maybe take 5% and put it into hiring someone to drive around the country and get meetings, then not only have you made the plan better, but now you have buy-in too. You have ownership. So it's not you agreeing with Howie's brilliant plan. It's our plan together because I created the space and allowed and encouraged us to do it together. So now we're both invested.
Great. Let's put some vocabulary to everything we've been discussing. So the first one, the first phrase, I should say the first term, is accent anxiety. So this is when we feel self-conscious about our pronunciation. It affects how we actually perform in high-stakes settings. So if I said something like, she's fluent in three languages, but accent anxiety still kicks in during board presentations. And the second one I mentioned earlier is gravitas. So being serious, of bringing a certain weight to how you speak. So don't confuse it with being formal. And I think there's a danger there of formality. Gravitas is more about substance. It's not about being stiff or rigid. So for example, if I said, he doesn't raise his voice, he doesn't need to. He has gravitas. And then the next word here, which I sometimes have trouble saying unless I've had my three espressos in the morning, but intelligibility. Intelligibility. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, right? It's this kind of rhythm. So this means just simply to be clearly understood. And for me, it's completely separate from accent. So if I say her intelligibility in English is excellent, you follow every word.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's one of those illity or itty endings that can just make words feel just slightly too long for the tongue.
And that's right. Generally speaking, when we have words that are three or four or five syllables long, we usually only stress one syllable. So here, I know that Bill is what I'm aiming for, right? So if I imagine I'm going up a little hill or mountain intelligibility, and then I'm going down again, right? Mm. So it's always this kind of small hill idea.
And if it's a word you're going to be using again and again, you practice it.
Exactly.
Right? Like I walk right around practicing the word for supply. It's abastecimiento. That's a lot of syllables. I have to practice it because it doesn't come out fluidly. It doesn't come trippingly off the tongue, which is also why I think you can speak slower in English, because it tends to have fewer syllables than a lot of other languages. So you say the same thing in Spanish and English in the same amount of time. You're just using four times as many syllables in Spanish. Now, let's stick with bluff, bottom line up front, which means lead with your main point, the thesis you're making, and that the follow-up is going to support it or defend it or modify it in some way. So this is a standard way to show gravitas, seriousness, and respect to your audience. So we could say, next time you email your manager, bluff it, or put the request in the first line.
Yeah, and I guess we should probably qualify this by saying that bluff it with a double F is a different verb, right?
You're pretending to have something you don't.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's definitely not double F bluff it.
No. Okay. What about one more?
Okay. How about hold the floor? I like the metaphors. So you're not actually down on your knees hugging the linoleum. By holding the floor means you have the attention of the people in the room to maintain attention and control of the conversation. She held the floor for 20 minutes without losing anyone. That's executive presence in action.
Great. And let's just move on to a couple of phrasal verbs. So the first one is to speak up. And this means, in this context, to voice your opinion or to contribute in a meeting. It's not just to speak louder. The professional meaning is the one that matters. So if I said, I noticed you didn't speak up during the Q3 review, when I've lived overseas and I've been sitting in on meetings with a language that isn't my first language, my tendency is to wait to be invited to speak. There's a difference between interrupting and speaking up. Okay, so the next one would be to back down. This is to withdraw from a position, maybe under pressure, maybe you're in negotiations and somebody has suggested something that is just unreasonable or too difficult to reach. So you're backing down. So if I said something like, she made her recommendation clearly, when they pushed back, she didn't back down. She explained her reasoning, for example. And then the flip side of that, backing someone up means supporting their position. So if I said, he backed me up in the meeting, he defended the idea when I needed it, for example.
All right, I'm going to stick with, instead of holding the floor, holding your ground, which comes from the military, meaning in a battle, you don't retreat. Your troops stay where they are, hold their ground. You maintain the position that you arrived with. So it's a way of saying, I'm not backing down. I am standing behind my position and holding my ground. So thanks for watching or listening to the Fluent Edge podcast. If you want to work on your English communication and, drum roll please, accent clarity, book a free discovery call with Sean.
And if you want to work on leadership communication or mindset, book a free discovery call with Howie. You can find our links in the description or show notes below. Until next time, keep it clear, keep it confident, and keep it human.
We'll see you on the edge.